Accession number 30255.
Douglas Ducky, reel 2.
At any rate, another occasion we defended London against an attack by the guards, and much to the chagrin, I don't remember how it happened, we captured the brigadier in charge of the guards, which wasn't supposed to happen. And another time there was an exercise, and we captured the coastal command headquarters at Northwood. We went out with somebody's old car, and we rode up there, and the chaps with me were pretty senior and more authoritarian than the young RAF guard, and they just sort of shouted at him, and he let us in, and we got to the centre of coastal command, which was quite good fun. And
so those were the kind of exercises that were taking place. Yeah.
Then the next stage, I suppose, I went to I was called up, you know, and went to Collingwood.
Okay, so this
1941.
And how did you feel about being called up?
Well, since I volunteered to go, I could hardly complain, could I? I think it's more the thoughtlessness of youth and bravery, or anything like that. You don't, as you get older, you bother and busy yourself more about things. I just went, and it was all right, Collingwood. And
tell me about Collingwood. So, can you remember your first week or?
I remember arriving there. I remember two things. When we arrived, we had to go and get changed into a uniform, leave our civilian clothes on the bed and on the beds. And the officer in charge went in with his stick and came out with somebody's underpants on the stick and said, "Whose are these?" and waved them around. I did feel for this poor devil and said, "We don't want anything like this." And I remember fussing more with irons and soap flakes in the Navy. I don't have to tell you too much. You must have gathered an awful lot.
No, but please do tell me again, because, I mean, some things I've heard, and you never know what we've heard and what we haven't.
We had to do our own dobying, you see, in the Navy, which you didn't do anywhere else. And and all this sort of ironing and all this. And, of course, the naval uniform, you wanted to look tiddly rather than pusser, and that was you had to make everything look aged, so you tried to bleach your collar, and people spent a mass of money on tiddly suits as opposed to their issue ones, you know, with a big cleavage and very wide bell bottoms, which were creased concertina up and down, and cap badges which they put in the front when you're supposed to have them at the side. And at any rate,
sorry, I was just going to add it. Because I've not heard that expression before.
Tiddly rather than passer. You see, issue. Passer for purser for issue, and tiddly for what you know, smart, or let's think of a better word than smart. Flamboyant, I think, is more the.
So it was kind of I thought the uniform requirements were so strict that there wasn't much room.
This is what you had to get away with where you could, and there was a certain amount of elasticity. I mean, why I like the Navy, but of its nature, it couldn't be like the Army. I mean, on a more serious note, as you must know, with MTBs, if you didn't fit in, it didn't matter what rank you were, you'd had it on an MTB. And there was no question much of you had to prove yourself, because you could be captain of an MTB and be a sub-lieutenant and have a sub-lieutenant under you. And you know, if you weren't sociable, you were in rare trouble. But what next? Where will we?
I was interested in this kind of the...
The uniforms,
yeah. Tell me more about that.
Portsmouth, I mean, the tailors there made a fortune from selling this stuff. And also, you had an allowance, you see, for buying. You bought your own equipment. So you could be quite popular, because some things, you know, were fairly unisex and so on, and if you could get them, you know, you could make yourself popular in the days of rationing. I mean, pyjamas, for instance. Girls could wear a pair of men's pyjamas just as well as a chap could, and so there was all this sort of domestic bit of the Navy. And when I got home, I think my mother was quite surprised, actually, that I was fairly clean and wholesome, and the clothes looked quite well looked after. And this was more important almost than the other training we had.
Yeah, so let me take you back, because I sidetracked you, but because we were actually talking about first day at Collingwood. It was the underpants on the stick.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
so what happened then?
We were a mixed bag, and there was one poor fellow who was a policeman there, and we had a lot of East Enders, and they weren't necessarily criminals, but they really didn't care for the police very much, and he had to fight for his life most of the time, which was rather unpleasant.
Yes. Sorry, the policeman.
This poor policeman, offence was taken where none was given, and he had to go out and sort of fight with these characters. It was a little unpleasant. I thought I might be in for a bit of trouble because of the way I spoke, which I suppose was of a certain style. And
because you had the Devon accent?
Well, I didn't.
Or not?
But whatever I thought I might be. And I nearly did. Until one night, they wanted to know what everybody's name was, and they found out that my third name was Lancelot. And they thought this was so hilarious, I was left alone from then onwards. You know, I was just Lancelot. And I mean, I thought it. So I was quite happy with this. It was. Collingwood was all right. We went through the usual things there, but nothing that others wouldn't have known about.
Can you remember, I mean, just the training process? Because, I mean, even things like on day one, you know, you lose your civilian clothes. I mean,
be quite honest, you see, the amount of training was very, very limited, really. I mean, there was a bit of square bashing and odd things like, learning to... there was a concrete plinth with a lifeboat and davits. And we did go out on Portsmouth Harbour rowing cutters and whalers and had a hard time from the upper yardmen. Now, upper yardmen were men who had joined the Navy with a view to being permanent Navy officers. I mean, you know about, you know, the RN are sailors and gentlemen, the RMV are gentlemen and not sailors, and the RN are, you know, sailors and not gentlemen. And they knew what I was, and a hard time. I mean, between the rowing, quite honestly, a cutter is fairly hard going for rowing. In fact, I wonder how I managed it, looking back at times. But they used to shoot questions at me. You know, I remember all sorts of odd stuff. The French have a 75mm gun. How much is that in inches? Well, when you're rowing, you know, all this. What frightened me, though, we used to go to... What was the ship there? There was some place where they had a hideous mast. And somebody was required to be button boy at the top, and I really thought I would die if I was asked to be button boy, but I never was.
What does button boy do?
Right on the top.
So what, some kind of lookout?
Yeah, right on the top. Standing, you know, they formed up on the yards. Anyway, some of the chaps didn't care for all this very much and went off home, and there was a bit of an inquest in Portsmouth, and they said none of us were to travel more than 10 miles away from our base. And
when was that? What was the...
The fair in the world, what's the base?
What was the inquest?
Why people were going home and not turning up and all this business.
So
I don't know how the two related, but that was the decision.
So there was a general... people weren't particularly enjoying the training process?
No, they didn't like it at all.
Because it was hard? or?
Just didn't like it, well, for various reasons, just didn't like it. I don't, some of them had never known any discipline, I suppose. If you'd been to a boarding school, you'd had a certain amount of discipline, I suppose, and we're used to it. But, anyway, this chap I got to know and I decided we were sick of, you know, wandering around Portsmouth with a thousand other matlows, you know, and nothing but beer and, yeah, I had no objection to a glass of beer, it wasn't there, but, you know, we decided we'd like to go and see Winchester, so we set off and went to Winchester, I think, on the bus, but it was a bit beyond the 10 miles, and when we were coming back, there wasn't a bus, so we decided we'd try and get a lift. So we walked out onto the road over the downs, and we took some apples from the tree by the roadside, and we were wandering along, and a cat in our hand was full of apples, when we saw a car coming, there was not much traffic. This, you see. Too late, we saw it was bearing a pennant, you see, on the bonnet, and it pulled up. With Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth, you see.
How unlucky.
So he said to us, where are you going, you see? And so we said, Collingwood. He said, I can't go to Collingwood right away. He said, you have to come to my sister's, get in the back. So he took us to this lovely old mill somewhere by Bishop's Waltham, and we had tea. Lovely tea in front of the log fire. I mean, yeah, you've got to believe that's true. And afterwards, we got in the back again and we said, well, he'd never been to Collingwood. So his driver took us to the gates at Collingwood, and the old chief who was on duty at the gate, who was in charge of us, couldn't believe the eyes and ears, you see, shouting, call out the guard and all this. And we emerged. Nobody said a bloody word to us. We just walked in and he departed. And I think some people think I made this up, but I can assure you it's true. And the chap I was with went out almost immediately afterwards, and he was killed in a destroyer ramming the boom at Algiers in 42, in the invasion of North Africa. And then what? Oh, I know the next thing. Yes, after training, I went to the barracks in Portsmouth. Now, it was intended for, I don't know, say 2,000 people. The number of people there was unbelievable. I've got an idea. It was something like 8,000.
So and how did they cram you all in?
Well, that's a good question. And there were so many, and it was all the sort of dross and of people who, you know, sort of lost contact with life, and they were all in here, and they remained there, some of them, because some of them wanted to be there and not go to sea.
So let me, I'm just thinking, what was that like? Because, you know, you've had this experience where, you know, you've been like, you're keeping yourself quite clean, you've been learning quite, you know, good rules, how to live well, and then you're
what was it like?
But also just to be with, you don't have a choice over the people you're keeping company.
Oh, no, you don't. Like? I couldn't do it now. I don't think I could do it now. I'd be far more, you know, squeamish and silly about it all, but you just got on with it. They had all this mob there, and so one day, a petty officer came up to me and said, where do you go to school? So I said, Cheviot College. He said, that's a public school, is it? So I said, no, it isn't. You know. And so he said, well, I'll have to do. He said, you're training commander's messenger. So off I was sent to training commander. It was just very nice. There was me and a wren and the training commander, and he had a nice little office, and it was quite nice. Now, this isn't very important, but my job was to look after him a bit, you know. And coffee and donuts were the big thing at Darien Barracks at that time. They used to make the donuts in huge vats every other day. Well, on the first day, they were okay. They were hot and slightly jammy, and they were pretty good. On the second day, the congealed fat around them, I had to get him his coffee and donuts hot from wherever it was back to the office, which was, I can't remember the geographical layout. In point of fact, this was a great difficulty. It was a long way round the parade ground, so it would be cold, but you weren't allowed to walk across the middle of the parade ground. You had to run, so I never quite sorted this one out. In the end, I think he said, "Well, use my bicycle." But he was about 7 feet tall, and I couldn't adjust it every time, so I was perched on this thing in the railway lines, liable to be in the into the harbour almost any time. At any rate...
Can I just check, because you mentioned the name of the barracks very quickly, I just didn't quite catch it.
Which?
You mentioned the name of the barracks.
It was the RM Barracks, Portsmouth, the central barracks in Portsmouth, yep. This was. And the culmination of this, the King decided to come down one day and review everybody there. And they had a jaunty, a master at arms and a leading hand in charge of drafting people, you know, the ordinary drafts, and they had long lists of names. A lot of people didn't want to go to sea. And the Killick actually, for 1 6 would move your name from the top of the list to the bottom. So some chaps have been there a long time. And this is all truthful. I'm not making this up as I go along.
No, I've just not heard it before. It's
the King came down to review everybody. Well, they decided everybody had to march past. And they sent all the petty officers around, digging out all these chaps. You imagine if there were 8,000 there, there were lots of nooks and crannies. So eventually this vast array of people were lined up in rows. And of course, they were all sorts and sizes and all sorts of uniforms and so on. It looked like the French Revolution as it went past the King rather than a naval display.
So what, I'm just trying to understand how this worked. So you had the system where there are all kinds of different people there, where for 1 6 they could get the names down the bottom of the list.
Yes.
So what were they doing with their time? I mean, were there people who'd been there for
quite some time? Oh, yes.
But yeah. What were they doing during the day?
Well, doing nothing much, very much, just wandering about. I mean, one job we were given to do, decided shrimps for tea, and I remember sitting with another chap. We had to deal with 2 barrels of shrimps. Don't forget the Navy could be utterly absurd. I mean, for instance, when ships were at sea around the area, the dress of the day had to be decided as to what it was. Well, you'd think the captain would decide this. He didn't. Portsmouth Command decided. So if it was raining when you were out in the Solent, but not in Portsmouth, you could still get negative jumpers or some daft thing, unless the captain decided to take no notice.
Negative jumpers?
Take your jumper off and just have you're under shirt on.
So that wasn't something, not only was that something you couldn't decide for yourself, the captain couldn't decide,
bureaucratic. And another thing that was rather fun too, one day I was told to make an assistant steward in the main wardroom, and they were entertaining various admirals, who'd come over, French and Dutch. The Dutch in particular thought a lot of themselves that day, and they had as good a spread as they were going to get in wartime. But they had sort of big silver tureen things in which there were, one lot had mayonnaise or salad cream or whatever, and one lot had custard. Unfortunately, they both looked the same. So the French and Dutch admirals got their salad with custard on, which was even they thought was a little unusual for English cuisine. At any rate, when I was in the training commander's place, I used to see everything that was going on. I used to see the papers, and I would have liked to have been a Fleet Air Arm pilot, but I'd had ear operations, and then the Navy was so popular, particularly Fleet Air Arm and Wrens, you just couldn't get it, but they did say there was a training course you could go on, ostensibly for the Fleet Air Arm, and I spoke to the training commander. He said, "We'll have a go at it," and this involved going up to Loughborough College for a time, which was very pleasant indeed. I mean, it was a long way from the sea, and they were a very interesting crowd of chaps who were on the same course, and we did sort of engineering, an engineering course up there. We we lived in Quorn Hall, which used to be the home of the Quorn Hunt pre-war, and we were pretty comfortable. Loughborough College was very advanced, and it's university now, my grandson's there. But even then it had facilities which were very unusual, like a swimming pool with an underground walkway so you could observe everything as you went around, all sorts of things. And for part of the time I lived at Quorn Hall, and part of the time with a Mrs. Adams, Nampanton on the edge of Loughborough, and shared it with another naval chap and an RAF sergeant and two dogs and a cat and loads of lace. And when we were given bicycles, and we used to ride into college in the mornings from Quorn Hall. And what amused the locals in those days, unmarried and single mothers were regarded as, you know, something almost criminal, and the pregnant unmarried women were sent up to Loughborough, and they had a place very close into Loughborough. In the mornings they all had to walk in something, they all walked in a great group. Well, the locals thought it's hilarious, because every morning you would see a host of pregnant women walking at Loughborough, closely followed by a load of sailors on bicycles, you see. I mean, it really was quite funny. At any rate, we did a course there, and
so this was see if you could be a fleet air arm.
Son?
This was see if you could be a fleet air arm pilot.
Yes, and to be in the fleet air arm, probably on the engineering side, chiefly engineering we were doing. And then I went up to... I'm losing the sequence a bit here. I've given you the wrong sequence.
That's okay.
Prior to going to Loughborough, actually, I was sent to the combined Fleet Air Arm and RAF station at Crail, which is at the mouth of the Firth of Forth, HMS Jackdaw.
So roughly when was this, just so I understand?
It's 42 to 43, I think we're talking about
okay.
Now.
So what happened at Crail?
Well, we just were given general instruction and on the aircraft, and were made to help in different roles as they occurred. We had some quite nice trips in Swordfish when they were carrying out dummy torpedo practice over the Firth of Forth, which was very interesting.
And what was your role on those trips?
I was just a sort of gash observer in the back behind the pilot, that was all. And there, because it was a combined RAF station, we didn't do our own washing and things, and didn't have the facilities for it, and the RAF did all this for us. And unfortunately, what they were using was some diabolical caustic soda or some damn thing. I'm not sure what it was, but it did for me, actually. I think I got fairly run down anyway, and I got to this rash and things. I went to see the surgeon commander, and he said, you know, you need a bit of time off. And he sent me down to a little sort of hospital which was in a house in Crail, in a long conservatory the ward was, jutting out to sea. And I really was just run down, I suppose, for want of a better word, and it wasn't too bad there for a few days. They had a Polish sister who was in charge, and I'm in medicine. I mean, I'm hopeless, but I used to wander around with the trolley behind this Polish sister and dish out medicines and things, and then I went back. But Crail was very interesting. It was bitter there. It really was bitter. We were on at this flat peninsula at night. It took three or four people to shut the hut doors at night. And because the Swordfish and biplanes are a bit unsteady, if they get a side wind, what they will do is tip onto their wingtip. So all night long, you would have duty watch turn out to turn aircraft into wind, you know, and alter them to face the oncoming wind. Then I went to Loughborough after being in Crail. So we did Loughborough, and I made a lot of friends there. Some of them lasted for years and years. They were an awfully interesting bunch of chaps. I mean, they really were all sorts of odd people. Did you ever come across the name Bill Grundy, or do you remember in your, I don't, you're probably too young for all this, do you remember the Sex Pistols?
Yes. Well, I know of the Sex Pistols.
Bill Grundy was one of us, and he was the one who interviewed the Sex Pistols on television when they used the F word for the horror for the first time. And they were just interesting chaps, they were. And then I'd finished there, and I was then a midshipman. And for some reason, they decided they didn't want me in the Fleet Air Arm, and I was at home for a short while, and I got a letter from Admiralty saying, you're to report to CFMSO Totten. Well, I hadn't any idea what CFMSO Totten was anyway. I set off and went to down there. And
Where was it? Where is Totten?
It's just the west of Southampton, and it was a coastal forces depot there, of which there were two in the country. And I was.
Is this sort of towards the end of 43, or?
This would be the end of 43, beginning of 44.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was.
Did you have a sense that this was going to be slightly more permanent than your other?
Well, this was the first real appointment. All the rest of the time I'd been swanning about officially being trained, you know, and I was told to go and live in the Anchor Inn on the just opposite the depot there. The depot was under the command of an older Lieutenant Commander Quanter, assisted by Lieutenant Madams, who had been manager of a GC electrical factory before the war. And there were about, I suppose, there must have been about 30 or 40 ratings and about 30 or 40 civilian people employed there. We serviced, as the name suggests, the different bases. We carried stock there of, you know, fuel tanks and props and discs and tubing and everything that you might expect for all the motor vessels, the coastal forces motor vessels. And over a period of time, we took over two houses, Blake's House and Bywater House, adjacent to the pier and pier station at Lymington, and part of the pier was under our jurisdiction, which included, I remember, a huge tank of sludge that had been left behind there. The two houses were totally unsuitable for our purposes, I think. They had extraordinarily lovely gardens and great areas of netted fruits of all kinds and flowers and camellias. One of the owners was a lady, and she actually refused to give up the keys to the Admiralty. And she locked the place up and ran away to Salisbury or somewhere where she had another place. And Quanter didn't know quite what to do about this. But at any rate, he managed to locate her and went to her and said, look, you're going to have to give up the keys. If you do it, I don't really want all the fuss I'm going to have if I say I can't control my own setup. I'll see you're all right for petrol for the rest of the war. So on that basis, she gave up her keys. Can I pause just for a second?
Yes, of course. Just
it's okay. Off we go. We'll try. If I mumble a bit, will I mumble a bit?
Well, mumbling's fine. I mean, why don't we Why don't we start with, so you're living in the Yankees at the pub opposite the depot.
Yes.
So what happens when you arrive there?